After the Stonewall Uprising, Martha Shelley thought, okay, this is our moment. She was an activist, a member of the Daughters of Bilitis, and she immediately started to organize. She got the Mattachine Society on board, and those two groups arranged for a protest march that would take place 1 month after Stonewall. Now, this march, it is estimated that somewhere between 400 and 500 people showed up that day, which were huge numbers for that time. This was 1969, and just to show your face in public, to publicly declare, I am gay or I am bi, that was still radical. Then, just a year later, on the anniversary of Stonewall, another march was held, the Christopher Street Liberation Day March. And this time, thousands of people attended. This march became an annual event and eventually turned into what we now know today as Pride. Martha Shelley was a key player at that first march. She was a part of some now legendary groups, like the Daughters of Bilitis, as I said, as well as the Gay Liberation Front, where she was one of their co-founders. Martha is also the author of the new memoir, We Set the Night on Fire. I'm Jeffrey Masters, and this is LGBT Q&A with Martha Shelley. So starting in 1963, you were 23 years old and joined the Daughters of Bilitis, which is, you know, one of the first lesbian groups and organizations in the U.S.
Right.
But before you joined, though, how did you first hear about that group?
There was a book. I think it was The Homosexual in America or something like that. And at the end, there was an appendix, and it gave the address of the Daughters of Bilitis in New York. And so I found it. And I found out, you know, when they were having a meeting and went there.
Wow. So what was your experience like at that first meeting?
I was really comfortable there. I was uncomfortable in the bars. I didn't dress right. It was a very butch femme kind of thing. You either had to dress very femme in a dress and makeup and stuff, or you had to dress like a man. And I would just show up in a pair of blue jeans and a plaid shirt, and people wouldn't relate to me at all.
In the book, you were writing about going to lesbian bars, and you used a word I'd never heard before, a kai-kai?
Kai-kai was the term that they used to use in the lesbian world for women who were neither butch nor femme. And it was not good to be one of those.
Oh, that was looked down on.
That was looked down on very much.
What percentage of, like, lesbians were kai-kai like you?
I have no idea. I didn't keep the statistics.
But like less than 50%?
I have no idea. For certainly.
Oh, okay.
Because you couldn't make it in that world if you were kai-kai. And then there were an awful lot of people who were married to men and had an affair on the side with a woman. Just like there were a whole lot of gay guys who will occasionally have sex with men, but are hiding within a heterosexual marriage.
Yeah. And so going back to the Daughters of Bilitis, what was like the work they were doing back then?
It was predominantly social, trying to help women meet each other and also to try to improve the situation for lesbians in the world. There was a magazine called The Ladder, and what it meant was we were going to climb the ladder of into society rung by rung and be accepted into this mainstream America. So it was very much a question of pleading for acceptance. And
in the book, you say they were pleading politely for acceptance.
Very politely, yes. And I wasn't a very polite person. At that point, had also become politicized on the left. I had been starting in either 63 or 64, I can't remember exactly when, been going on anti-war marches, going to Washington on buses with other friends, and protesting the war. And by the time the Vietnam War was happening, I had become very disillusioned with mainstream America, to say the least. By the time I got into Gay Liberation Front, by the time we started that, it was very clear to me that what I wanted was not to join mainstream America, but to completely overturn the system. And I was a socialist by then.
And so being like somebody who like protested the war, that created some conflict for you, right? I'm thinking, for example, of in May of 1966, in cities across the U.S., there were, you know, gay people protesting, demanding to be let into the military. And then here you are, an anti-war protester.
I didn't even know that was happening at the time in 1966. I found out years later and I was outraged. I thought, into the military? Hell no. Get shipped to Vietnam to kill people who had never done anything wrong to us or to be killed? Hell no.
Wow. And so you were a member of the Daughters of Bilitis on the night of Stonewall.
Yes.
June 28th, 1969. And you were giving a tour to two other women that night in Greenwich Village.
Right.
Take the story from there. What did you see and hear?
We were walking along on Christopher Street and we saw these young people. The image in my mind, what I remember, is this young white guy with blonde hair throwing things at cops. And the women that I was with, were taken aback, and they said, "What's that?" And I said, "Oh, it's just a riot. We have them all the time." And I thought it was an anti-war demonstration. I mean, I'd been in a number of those. So we just moved on, and I took them back to where they were staying at Jean's apartment and went off to see my partner, the woman I was having an affair with at the time, and didn't know that it was the Stonewall riot. That was Saturday night. I didn't know about it till Monday morning when I read this little article in the New York Times. And, oh, my God, I was on fire. I thought, this is our moment. This is our not refusing to sit in the back of the bus. This is our chance. And I called Jean and I said, we have to have a protest march.
And so what about the New York Times article about it, like, signal to you, like, it's like magnitude?
Because it was homosexuals who had been rioting. And that meant to me, that was us. That was us standing up. Instead of being carted off into paddy wagons, hiding our faces behind newspapers or jackets or whatever, and being humiliated. These were young people who weren't going to take it anymore.
I brought the quote from the New York Times. Heavy police reinforcements cleared the Sheridan Square area of Greenwich Village again yesterday morning when large crowds of young men, angered by a police raid on an inn frequented by homosexuals, swept through the area.
That's it. That's very neutral. It's not positive towards gay people. It's not negative. But I saw that and I thought, that's us. That was what I saw on Saturday night.
And so you call Jean and say, she's head of the Daughters of Bilitis in New York. You say, we have to do a protest.
I said, we should. I said, we have to have a protest march.
What was her reaction to that?
She said that I should call the head of the gay men's organization, the Mattachine Society, and if they agreed that the DOB, Daughters of Bilitis, and the Mattachine Society would jointly sponsor a march.
How much interaction did, like, the Daughters of Bilitis and Mattachine Society have back then?
I don't know. Ours was the women's group and theirs was the men's group. And I'm sure there was some communication. I hadn't been involved with Mattachine at all.
Because now, like, the movement is, like, one. It was very separate back then.
Yes, it was very separate. Because a lot of it had to do with people getting together who wanted to meet other people like themselves, who wanted to find love.
And so was it hard to convince them to do this protest march?
Hell no. Dick Leitch, who was head of Mattachine, said that they were having a meeting, I think, the next Thursday night at some downtown center, and I could come and make my proposal. He didn't sound very enthusiastic. So I showed up, and there was a lot of talk. There was, like, I think about 400 guys there.
Wow. That's a huge group.
Yeah, it was really huge. They rented the hall to people to talk about this thing because it was a really new thing that there was such a riot, that gay people were actually fighting back. And people talked. And then when it was my turn, I raised my hand and I made my proposal. And Dick Leitch said, how many people want to have a protest march? And I looked around and everybody's hand was up. And he said, those people who want to organize it, meet over in that corner. He pointed it to a corner and form a committee to organize it. So that meeting was, I think, with the 400 guys on a Thursday night right after the riots. On Saturday morning, Saturday afternoon, actually, our little committee met at Mattachine headquarters. And we arranged for that first protest march to take place exactly 1 month after Stonewall. But to me, the important thing about Stonewall is not that there was a riot, because there had been, I think, at least one other gay riot on the West Coast. But nothing happened in terms of organizing after that. The important thing about Stonewall was that we organized, that we reached out to other groups. We didn't just have our protest march. We formed, at that Saturday meeting when we were organizing the march, when we first started to organize the march, we also started the Gay Liberation Front.
Yes.
And that group reached out to the Black Panthers, to the Young Lords, to the women's movement, to various socialist groups, and made alliances and changed the attitudes in those groups. The Black Panthers were pretty homophobic in their writings, in their newspaper. They would call people they didn't like faggots. That changed because we reached out to them. We went to their convention in Philadelphia and changed their minds. The women's movement was really homophobic. Well, the mainstream women's movement, the radical women's movement was not. We had no problem with them. But National Organization for Women, they were terrified of being called, quote, man-hating dykes. And I think it was 1970, we crashed their conference in New York City as the Lavender Menace, which is what Betty Friedan called us. And we changed their minds. And after that, they changed their policy so that they included a plank in their program for lesbian rights.
So everyone is obsessed with, like, what happened or didn't happen on the night of Stonewall, or nights of Stonewall, I guess. And you're saying what matters is, like, everything that happened right after.
What mattered was the organizing and reaching out to other people, throwing bottles or bricks or whatever at a few cops, getting arrested, going home. That doesn't change the world. What changes the world is organizing.
Wow. So describe the protest. What was, like, the atmosphere? Was it, like, fun and jovial? Was it serious?
You mean the march that we had?
Yeah.
It was serious. We marched around, according to the police. There was undercover police there, and I found out much later that they were there. There were about 400 gay people. According to the Village Voice reporter who was there, there were about 500. And most of those people had not been out in public, in the sunshine, openly gay in their lives. I was the public spokesperson for Daughters of Bilitis at the time because I was young and didn't have a career to lose and was a flaming radical. But I think in the whole United States, you could count the openly gay people on the fingers of your hands, maybe on one hand even. And there they were, 400 or 500 people marching in the sunshine, marched around the village, ended up back in front of Stonewall in Christopher Park. But the first thing, Marty Robinson jumped up on that water fountain and made a speech, which we'd previously agreed on. He was making a speech for the boys. I jumped up and made a speech for the girls. And then I looked out and I saw these faces and they were like looking up at me expectantly. And I realized we're not going to have another riot now. We don't need that. So I said, okay, we're going to go home peacefully. We're not going to have another riot. But this is not the end. This is just the beginning. We will be back. I remember that. I don't remember anything else I said that day.
Wow. And Marty Robinson's a pretty, like, legendary activist. He was a founding member of the Gay Activist Alliance, GLF, Gay Liberation Front, GLAAD, ACT UP. He died in the AIDS crisis.
That's right, he did.
His name pops up in, like, everyone's books.
He was a total sweetheart. And I remember having a meal with him at a restaurant, a couple of years later, and he said that he was really a romantic, and what he really wanted was someone, you know, to love him.
Oh.
And I felt so bad when I heard that he died. Because I don't know if he ever got that.
Wow, that's heartbreaking. Tell me this, though. How did this first march evolve into, like, the prides we see today?
Yes. 1 year later, some of our people organized the Christopher Street Liberation Day march, which, you know, this all morphed into what we now have the Pride Parades.
Yeah.
And there were 10,000 people marching up 6th Avenue from the Village to Central Park. And boy, I could see people leaning out the windows then, looking out, smiling, waving flags, or, you know, sitting there and having a cocktail in the afternoon or whatever they were doing. It was a really positive atmosphere.
Pride's changed like a shit ton since, you know, this time. Do you still go?
I haven't been because of COVID.
Oh.
I really avoid crowds these days. You know, for one thing, I'm going to be 80 this year.
Yeah.
So my immune system isn't what it was. And my wife has a congenital heart problem, and the doctor said if she catches it, she's most likely to die. And this is a woman who never drank, smoked, used drugs, always took care of herself. Bad genes.
Wow.
So we'll have to be careful. And she managed to live this long. She's 70 now.
Wow. As you said, from the planning of this march in 69, the 1 month after Stonewall won, from that came the group, the Gay Liberation Front, from people meeting from Mattachine and Daughters of Bilitis. Why was that new group, like, necessary? Like what wasn't working with, like, Mattachine and DOB?
Because Mattachine and DOB overall were not going to— they didn't want to be associated with groups like the Black Panthers. They wanted, again, to be, quote, part of the mainstream. They didn't want to be labeled commies. They really were single-issue groups. They didn't want to link with any other issues. But it didn't get them anywhere. It really didn't change society. Nevertheless, they were the pioneers who made us possible.
And you learn those lessons from them.
Yeah.
Like, we need to link up. We need to care about other causes.
If it weren't for Daughters of Bilitis, I would not have become the public speaker that I was. And I wouldn't have had much of a lesbian life at all. I mean, because I, you know, didn't fit into the bar scene. If it weren't for them, I wouldn't have been motivated to start Gay Liberation. I would have been motivated, would not have been motivated to start that march.
Yeah.
It was that kind of that platform where I jumped up to the next level.
So Gay Liberation Front, that's an important group. At the time, what would they've said their goals were?
We had a platform, which we essentially made up when we went to the Eastern Regional Conference of Homophile Organizations. I think that was in the fall of 1969. Yeah, definitely in the fall. And it was in Philadelphia. And our platform was the right to control your own body. And that meant the right to have sex with other consenting adults, your choice. The right to ingest the drugs of your choice. Now, remember, this was at a time when people were being, like in Texas, given life imprisonment for having two joints of marijuana. So there was that whole war on drugs where they were starting the process of mass incarceration of people. And if you wanted to smoke a joint, God forbid, you know, the right to not have your ass drafted and shipped to Vietnam to kill or be killed. And women's reproductive rights.
Really?
Yes. Right to control your own body. That was part of our platform.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. I knew women who'd had abortions, illegal abortions back then.
My question is like I don't know if this being sensitive, but I can imagine gay men like me back then and those days being like, Martha, we have a massive uphill battle to fight for like gay rights. Like, we'll deal with abortion later, you know? Like, was that a fight or like?
No, that wasn't, that had nothing to, that might have been true in Mattachine Society and the people who stayed there. But with Gay Liberation Front, no. The guys in Gay Liberation Front were all flaming feminists as well.
I see.
Besides being aware of racism, they were aware of sexism, but both in terms of the sexism against gay people and sexism against women. At that Eastern Regional Conference, there was this one guy who, when we talked about, when we added that plank about abortion rights, he got really upset and he was furious and against that. But there were two women there from Daughters of Bilitis. I was representing Gay Liberation Front and Daughters of Bilitis simultaneously. Mm. And there were these two older women. One of them had had an illegal abortion. She'd been raped. And they jumped up and they were furious. And because of their fury, that whole plank passed. All of the organizations voted to accept the Gay Liberation Front plank.
You know, the Gay Liberation Front, I've often heard about the dances they'd host, like for all the guys. But I love that you write about the wins for just the women and like the freedom you felt.
Yeah. And with summer nights, we could strip to the waists like the guys would because there were nobody or, you know, no men in the room. We would dance in circles rather than, you know, coupling up just to celebrate all of us being together.
Wow.
No one was left out. And it wasn't a question of this particular person, you know, it wasn't just hooking up for sex or for possible future stuff. It was celebrating our community.
With all of the like relationships that happen amongst, the women, but all the people in the groups, did that like ever like make things difficult and challenging? Like, you know, like when breakups would happen or somebody would sleep with somebody else?
I don't think it affected the group as a whole. My personal affairs didn't really affect my political actions. And I've, you know, had my own breakups.
Yeah. You keep referring to them as affairs. Is that just like a different like terminology, or are you like, I consider an affair like in today's world, like, you know, you're sleeping with somebody like you should not sleep with. But
oh,
you were
no.
Just saying they were relationships, right?
Yeah, this were relationships. Okay, there was Allison, the woman who I had been having a relationship with since sometime. I think I went home with her one night drunk after a party, and we spent the night together at her place in New Jersey. And I woke up and I thought to myself, slightly hungover, I think she said her name was Allison. But that began a relationship that only ended, I mean, the sexual relationship lasted for about 8 or 9 months until she was about 40, and I was, 25 at the time. And then she met somebody her own age and went with her. But our friendship lasted until she died. That was maybe in 2006, 2007. And the woman that she became lovers with, they were lovers until death. That was Marion. And Marion, she was from overseas. She came to New York. She was a member of the Parti Communiste de France. And she became my mentor in Gay Liberation Front. We used to meet for lunch near where she worked because her day job was editor for Crowell Collier Macmillan. And she would give me books to read and became my mentor for years. And then when she was, I think it was 2015, 2016, She was diagnosed with terminal cancer, and my wife and I brought her to Portland and took care of her until she died.
At your home in Portland?
Yes. She was... I still miss her. I wrote a poem to her called A Woman of Courage, because she was courageous.
You know, speaking of your poetry, too, I did want to talk about the radio show you hosted where you spoke to poets, but also writers and many other women. This was called Lesbian Nation. You hosted it from 1972 to 1974, and it actually brought a clip. Should we play it?
Sure.
Okay.
This is Martha Shelley, as usual. I'm out here in Staten Island with Audre Lorde, and she's going to read some poetry for you. And the stars are out, and we're going to have a good time. And I've already started because I've had some sherry.
Well, I recognize the voice. It's me with that Brooklyn accent.
You write that working there for the radio show, it changed your life, you say?
Yeah.
How so?
Well, I had, I learned some skills. I got to meet a whole lot of people. And it was a very rich experience, interviewing all these people and then taking my little cassette recorder, which is what we used in those days, and traveling around the U.S. and doing interviews. That was great.
As we said, though, like, people were not, like, out of the closet. Like, back then, they were not, like, publicly out?
Oh, yes, they were.
Okay, so you had no trouble getting people on the show?
Oh, no.
Okay.
And I remember some of the famous people, but there were also others who were, I covered a women's softball match. Yeah, people were out very much.
Oh, so, we're talking about 72 to 74. That was a quick change in the 60s.
Yes.
Really?
It was a very quick change from 1969. All of a sudden, more and more people were out, and people were writing books.
The radio program was on WBAI. I don't mean this in a rude way, but like, it's the 70s. Why did they want a program about lesbians? Like, that seems like unusual to me for that time.
They had a program director. They had a feminist program director. I think it was the first time they had a woman doing being the program director, Nanette Reynon. And in addition to the other feminist programming, Nanette, who was straight, by the way, asked me to do this lesbian program. Because at that point, I had already been involved in doing all of this newspaper stuff, come out newspaper and rat newspaper. And I guess she thought I could do it, so I did.
And you're 80 years old now. How much are you still involved in activism today?
Yes, but what I do is I write these blog posts, political stuff. Because of COVID, I cannot go to demonstrations, and I dearly wish I could. And, I'll send money to groups and try to support groups. And when I go around and do readings, what I do is at the end of the readings, I ask people what they're doing in terms of activism. I talk about what the current priorities are. And for me, the big priorities are two. One of them is the climate, because if we all fry, then, whatever, our rights don't mean anything. And the second is economic inequality. And those two are really connected, because the people who are very, very rich have no interest whatsoever in changing the climate as long as they can make money out of fossil fuels. And then I ask young people what they're doing. What I want to do when I go out there is to encourage people to take up the torch, say, okay, I can do what I can in the little time that I have left. Now you guys go. The older generation of gay people couldn't write the script for us of what to do. We can't write the script for you, but you do have to read history and find out what other people did in various times in history, what worked then, what didn't work, and think about what you can do in your time with the current problems that are facing you. In every generation, a new pharaoh arises to oppress us. This is something we say at Passover. And the corollary is, in every generation, we have to fight back.
I think that's a great place to end it. Martha, thank you so much for doing this and for being here in person. This was fantastic.
Very welcome.
And that is Martha Shelley. She is the author of the memoir, We Set the Night on Fire, and it is out now. Then that clip you heard from her radio show, Lesbian Nation, is a part of her larger archives at the Lesbian Herstory Archive. So more of that is available on our website if you want to check that out. The website is lesbianherstoryarchive.org. And then I should say, too, that on our Substack are some really fantastic photos of Martha that I think you'll love. Those are from her early days as an activist. So if you want to check those out, those are on our Substack, and there's a link in our show notes to that. All right, I will leave you here with one final story from Martha. This is something she told me right as we were saying goodbye, and luckily the mic was still rolling.
A young man who interviewed me a couple of years ago asked me how I would like to be remembered, and I said, I don't care. I will be dead. What I care about is, what am I doing today to make a better world? What am I doing to help my neighbors? What can I do today to improve things? That's it, day by day. And then at night, when I go outside, because it's not like New York where I live, we have a little backyard farm. I go out to lock up the chickens or to take out the garbage, and I look up at the stars, and I remember my place in the universe. I am a little tiny dust mote on an insignificant planet that's maybe 4 billion years old, in a universe that's maybe 13 billion years old, if the theories are correct. And I do what I can in this life, but we're really not that important.